Today is December 4th, 2013, and this is episode number 233 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, Archer's understudy. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at ACM@macobserver.com. Now, I take it you watch Archer?
Yes, I do.
It's a funny show, man.
It's a wonderful show. It's a brilliant show. So amazingly, awesomely done.
It is, yeah. It's offensive, by the way. If you haven't seen Archer,
you're not living.
You're not well, at least not in our opinion. It's a cartoon that follows an incredibly dysfunctional spy agency that is set in a combination of 2013 and 2020 and 1967.
That's exactly right. Yeah. What an awesome, awesome description!
It's kind of like Seinfeld taken to the nth degree
with spies.
Yeah. Very, very funny. Very, very. It's like this wonderful combination of slapstick and what I think is very cerebral, very, very, very smart humor.
And people that just can't keep it in their pants.
It's true. Yeah. And it's super offensive. There are people listening to us right now, Jeff, that would be horrified by Archer.
Sorry, Mom. Oh, who am I kidding? My mom doesn't listen to anything I do.
Yeah, fair enough. My mom does, though. And
your mom does.
She does. And
hi, Brian's mom.
She would probably not enjoy the Archer. I'm just thinking.
No, she probably wouldn't.
Hi, Mom.
Don't watch Archer, Brian's mom.
Indeed. Indeed.
The rest of you, go watch Archer.
Yeah, for sure, right? Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
Yes, I lived through it, just like one should. Yes.
That's good. That's good. I of course didn't know that because I haven't spoken to you since the last time we sat across from each other in the recording booth a week ago.
Yeah, it's not the restraining order thing again, is it?
Mm-mm. It's mere timing and happenstance.
Yeah, well, the Thanksgiving holiday is often a whirlwind of activity, and it certainly was for me.
Indeed. I'm glad everything worked out okay, though.
Me too.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you had a good Thanksgiving as well. And notice I didn't ask if you had a good Thanksgiving. I just simply assumed.
You just assumed, yeah. It's pretty reasonable. It's pretty reasonable. So, let us kick things off. Let's kick things off with Apple v. Judge Coate.
Funny you should pick that topic, because it's as if there's nothing to say. Yeah, right. This is turning into like a real soap opera plot. I mean, we're down to the point where it looks like through the documents that Apple is filing with the court that they're putting their sights on Judge Coate now. This isn't just about the whole trial.
Apple versus Judge Coate. This time it's personal.
Bum, bum, bum.
In a world where an electronics giant is thwarted by the will of one judge, only one can emerge victorious.
Does that sound about right?
That sounds totally spot on. Yeah, that's it exactly. And at that point, you cut to the quick shot of Phil Schiller standing there with a machine gun braced on his hip, going, as he's firing.
Bandolier shirtless with a bandolier bullets.
So you've seen the footage as well.
Yeah, I have, yeah. Yeah, that's good stuff. That's good stuff. You know, if I'm really industrious, I'll put some I'll like boost the bass when I did my little trailer voice and put some EQ on or put some reverb on it.
Oh, that'd be perfect.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that at this point the listeners already know about that.
Yeah, well, you see, I have said before that our podcast is wibbly wobbly timey wimey. This is proof that that we are not living in a linear time fashion when we record.
It's true. It's almost like it's a topsy turvy world.
Something like that.
Something like that. All right. So, Apple Judge Coat, Apple v. Judge Coat. Now, what we're talking about is Apple's ongoing battle with the U.S. government in regards to iBooks and iBooks pricing, and the fact that Apple is, at this point, a convicted antitrust offender.
Yes. And so this is the case that became big news last year when the Department of Justice filed a lawsuit against Apple and the big book publishers for allegedly colluding to artificially raise the price of books.
Technically, it's no longer allegedly.
Well, for Apple, it isn't. For the book publishers, it is, because they settled out of court and, as part of their settlement, did not have to admit to any wrongdoing.
Good point. Good point. So we've talked about this a lot because it's it's interesting to me because we're both fans of iBooks. I read a ton of books on iBooks, and of course we're both fans of Apple. And then I've got the added thing that I'm still working on my first novel. So I'm kind of interested in how books get sold. And then there's, of course, the Apple versus Amazon competition. And yeah, so we've talked about it often. And the result was that the trial actually concluded in May, right? Wasn't that all the way back in May?
Oh, geez. Was it really that long ago? That's totally possible. And regardless of when it ended...
They were convicted. Judge Coat handed down her verdict in the summer, and she found Apple guilty of colluding and being the ringmaster of this price collusion with the publishers. And that's the thing that we talked about quite a bit. Part of her remedy, part of the remedy that the Justice Department was looking for, because the Justice Department wasn't looking for damages. Justice Department was looking for only a curb on Apple's practices.
Right. Yeah. Yes. That's a great way to put it.
And part of what they wanted was for Apple to have an outside monitor. They wanted, I think, for Apple to have a monitor for a long time. And the Justice Department also wanted Apple to be that Apple would be prevented from making the kinds of deals it had made with the iBooks store everywhere else. They were looking for really sweeping restrictions on what Apple could do.
Which is really, I find to be really interesting, especially the whole monitor part, because this is not a common remedy in this type of situation. And what I mean by that is we're talking about activity that happened over basically a 3-month window, and it was a couple years prior to the case. So this is not a drawn out series of activities.
Well, let's actually couch this a little bit differently. The reason why we're talking about it today is there was a tiff that began between Apple and the outside monitor that was appointed, whose name is Michael Bromwich. And the tiff that began between those two was because Mr. Bromwich was billing Apple $1,100 an hour and charging a 15% administrative fee on top of that. And Apple didn't want to pay that.
Right. And to go along with that, he was acting in a fashion that Apple interpreted to be beyond the scope of his duties. Meaning, I said duty, meaning he was... demanding to have interviews with all of Apple's top-level executives and with board members. And these people were not people that would be able to offer any useful information to him as far as the whole iBooks and book pricing negotiation.
Okay, and the reason why we're talking about that, because the other story broke over Thanksgiving weekend. And what happened this week, though, the reason why we're talking about that on the show, about this on the show, is that Fortune ran a fantastic piece by a guy named Roger Parloff, who is their veteran senior editor for legal affairs. And he did, this is like 3,300 words, a really huge, huge article, giving us a lot of background information and a lot of insight on what's going on in this case. And he is the one who brought to light the fact that Michael Bromwich was asking for meetings with all these people. And again, as Jeff said, these are people that have nothing to do with iBooks. And, you know, Judge Coate originally wrote that she intended for the remedy to rest on Apple's shoulders as lightly as possible.
And that's not exactly how this feels.
No, this guy... So he feels like when Judge Coate interviewed him, he said, I want to hit the ground running. I want to be really strong in this. And the fact that he was picked, therefore, to him is a mandate to go in strong.
But the interesting thing about that is that the ground that he's supposed to hit and run on doesn't actually exist until like the middle of January.
Well, and that's Apple's take. Apple's take is, what do you mean you're coming in strong? You're supposed to, you know, this is supposed to be resting lightly on our shoulders, and we've got work to do. You don't need to talk to 15 of our top executives and all 8 of our board members. So it's, you know, because most of these people don't have anything to do with anything that you're looking at. And so Apple wants to push back, and this guy wants to push forward, and of course that's where we actually had the friction. The real friction here wasn't about the money. The real friction that we're seeing come to light is this guy's tactics, and the fact that Judge Coate seems to be backing those tactics up. And that's the interesting story.
Yes, and it's fascinating because it really does sound like what he's doing is outside the scope of his assignment. But Judge Coate doesn't seem to think so. And this is even going to the point where he's been in a position where he could have private meetings with Apple executives and then have private meetings with Judge Coate, meaning there are no attorneys or other witnesses at any of these meetings. And his meetings with Judge Coate would not include any sort of record of the conversation.
Yeah, they're called ex parte.
Right. Now, Judge Coate, I believe, has since said, no, that hasn't been happening.
And it won't happen.
And that it won't happen.
But I believe that he does still have the power to talk to Apple executives without counsel present.
And that's an interesting point.
Yeah, that seems to be pretty offensive.
Does he really have that authority? And if so, where does that come from?
Right. And, you know, so part outside monitors are really weird. This is what Jeff was talking about when we first got in here. Outside monitors are rare, and there's not a lot of precedent, you know, to have these things worked out. And part of the reason why they're rare is they tend to only be inflicted upon companies that either agree to it or have exhibited a history of not playing nicely with the courts and the DOJ, you know, being recalcitrant, not respecting the rule of law, which actually may apply to Apple in this case, and you know, who basically have been egregious in their violations of antitrust laws and regulations. For instance, Microsoft.
Right, and Microsoft is a great example, because another part that plays into this is these companies that end up with monitors typically have a long track record of whatever action it is that landed them in hot water. And Apple doesn't have that in this case. They right. have essentially one quarter. And
yeah, it was a two-month period. It started really. It started in late November, and was wrapped up by early January. And this was the negotiations with the publishers to move the entire publishing industry for eBooks to the agency model, where retailers were no longer controlling the prices. That's what Apple wanted, and that's what Apple got.
And now they have a monitor.
And now they have this monitor. So initially. So Apple is, of course, appealing, right? You know, Apple was convicted by Judge Coate, who said ahead of time that she pretty much thought that Apple was guilty, and who, you know, you and I have talked about this. We had Philip Amor DeWitt on the show to discuss it. You know, I think all three of us thought that the evidence really did not back we up the DOJ's case.
We thought the evidence supported Apple.
It, to me, even a lot of the DOJ evidence seemed to support
Apple. I would agree.
And so I still find her verdict to be mystifying. I still don't understand how the company entering a market controlled by a monopolist, which is Amazon, is somehow the bad guy. It's still quite weird to me. And what it appears is that the nature of Apple's filings regarding Michael Bromwich, the outside monitor, is that Apple is gearing up to have to force Judge Coate to recuse herself from the case, from the ongoing case, I should say.
I think you're right. I think that's part of the strategy now. And I have to jump back just a little bit, because there's a key point that I think a lot of people at this point either don't know or don't remember, simply because there's been enough time. But the DOJ's case against Apple needed was some outside consulting so that they could really figure out what was going on and put their case together. One of those outside consultants was Amazon. So a lot of the information that the DOJ used was presented and couched in such a way that it was helpful for Amazon. And of course, because as an outside consultant, Amazon was in a really good position, whether they intended to or not, to help mold the DOJ's case so that it would be Amazon friendly.
Yeah, and it sure seems like that was the case.
Yeah.
It sure seems like that was the case.
And so now we have Apple filing their complaint about the way Bromwich is conducting business. But we don't have a response from the court or the DOJ yet. Although Bromwich has essentially said, look, these are the rules, and I can do whatever I want, and you'll pay whatever I say, and you'll be glad for it.
Well, but I think that needs some context too.
I'm doing a really great job of tossing stuff out so you can give context. It's almost like we're a team.
The context for that is this. I think Apple is trying to treat Mr. Bromwich as a consultant. Like, Apple's trying to shape the relationship in such a way that it is dictated and controlled and governed. Actually, I guess governed is a good word here. By Apple's rules that it has with its for its consultants. For instance,
yes.
When Mr. Bromwich tried to present, or when, I'm sorry, when Mr. Bromwich did present his bills to Apple, Apple reminded him that their rules say that per diem meals are X amount. I think it's 10 bucks for breakfast, 15 bucks for lunch, and 30 bucks for dinner.
Yeah, that's about so, right.
Whatever.
It's
some amount, but it's roughly in that area. And I think that was part of what was flipping Mr. Bromwich out, because he's like, I'm not an outside consultant. I'm not governed by your rules. I don't really care what rules you have with your consultant, because I happen to be effectively an instrument of the court. And therefore, you'll pay what it is that that I'm going to charge. And if you have a problem with it, take it to the courts.
Now, the fact that he acknowledged that he's an instrument of the court, I find to be very interesting, because he's acting as if he has no restrictions on himself. And the very nature of being an instrument of the court means that you have very strict guidelines and restrictions on what it is that you can do.
Yeah, but Judge Cote has exacerbated that by, you know, when she's reacted to this stuff, she's reacted in sort of vague ways.
And that's a really big problem. There should be no vagaries here at all. There should have been nothing vague from the onset. And certainly now that Apple is questioning the actions of the court-appointed monitor, there should be very cut and dry answers coming out.
Yeah,
and we're not getting that.
I agree with that. Yeah, it seems to me there should be cut and dry answers on who he's allowed to talk to, how much he's allowed to charge. I mean, like these to me, these should be guidelines established by the court, because the court said that you have to have a monitor and you have to pay for that monitor. So if the court's going to say that, the court should then also say, and this is how much you're going to have to pay. And yes, this is who he can talk to, and this is, you know, this is how much time he can demand. And, you know, when the monitor runs into a situation, like let's say, for instance, that he starts talking to the people that he needs to talk to, and he finds a problem. At that point, if he needs more time, to me, it seems like he should have to go back to the courts and say, look, I need, you know, this isn't working. There's a real problem here. I've got to root it out. So, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's how the process works.
Seems like it should, at least.
Yes. And being able to say, I need to have an interview with Johnny Ive, that is outside the scope of his assignment.
Yeah, Johnny Ive has nothing to do with iBooks, and Johnny Ive has nothing to do with antitrust compliance. And neither, I'm sure there's one or two board members that he could legitimately want to talk to, but not all eight. He probably doesn't need to be able to demand meetings with Tim Cook and... Well, Phil Schiller is probably a fair game, because Eddie Q. No, Eddie Q does not answer to Phil. It seems like Eddie Q is the top executive that he should be able to demand interviews with.
Yeah, I'll have to agree with you on that. That, yeah,
it really does. You know, and then of course lawyers within Apple.
Right.
And like one of the things he tried to do, he was demanding a meeting with Bruce Sewell, who is Apple's is it chief counsel or general counsel?
General counsel.
Apple's top legal officer. And he was doing this in the middle of Apple's trial with Samsung.
Yeah, so he's not even around Cupertino, because he's deeply involved in
Samsung stuff. He was actually probably technically in Cupertino. San Jose, because that court case was in San Jose.
Oh, that's right. Yep.
So he, you know,
so yeah.
But he's,
he, you probably wasn't around. Nonetheless,
he was busy. And of course, the other thing that Jeff mentioned at the top was that part of the monitor's job here is to monitor their ongoing compliance and training and behavior. And their compliance, their new training, their new policies are not due to the courts until January 14th.
Right. So at that point, he has a job to do.
Yeah.
until then, there really isn't anything for him to be doing.
Right, because he's monitoring. He's not crafting. He's not shaping. He's monitoring. He's, at least he's supposed to be monitoring.
Right. And so how does an interview with Johnny Ive equate to monitoring Apple's activities related to antitrust and ebook price negotiations?
That is a good question. And there was, what was one of the, I didn't include this in my coverage, the Fortune piece. Let me find, is it Expedient?
Type faster. Faster. Faster.
She wrote a ruling where she basically told him to do this stuff with, do you remember that? You've read it more recently because you just finished this today, right?
I did.
Was the part where he's supposed to proceed with you know, the kind of urgency?
It was very vague. So the way the wording that Judge Coate gave makes it unclear if he just has carte blanche to do whatever he wants, or if he can do what he wants without having legal representation.
With all there. Reasonable diligence.
Yeah, it's just very vague.
He was supposed to proceed with all reasonable diligence, which is vague, but it's very reasonable to interpret that as backing up his aggressive approach. I think that is a reasonable interpretation of that, that all reasonable diligence means full steam ahead, sir.
I believe that is exactly how the court is interpreting that. And I think you're right. That's how Judge Coate intends it. It is worded in a vague way, but I think that's how Judge Coate intends it.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I hope, we've said this before, but I strongly hope that Apple beats this on appeal. The verdict was wrong.
I think the verdict was wrong. I think putting the monitor in place was inappropriate. And what I am interested in seeing is what happens after Apple starts after the ball is really rolling with Apple's appeal. They have to file documentation with the court by February. And part of what they're going to file is a motion to stay the monitoring during the appeal process.
Right. Right, and that could give us an indication on how the appellate court is going to treat the case.
Yeah, if the appellate court grants the stay, then that tells me that they are more inclined to side with Apple than not.
Yes.
And if they don't, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are siding with the DOJ. Just that for whatever reason, they didn't feel it was necessary to stop the monitoring process.
Right. And, you know, and there's one more thing about the monitoring process that I think bears noting. The publishers in this case have already agreed not to do agency pricing.
Right. So what the monitor is monitoring is an action that Apple couldn't take even if they wanted to.
Yes.
Because the people that they would do it with aren't going to.
Yes. So, which again begs the question of why the monitor was necessary in the first place. And yes. And keep in mind, I mean, Apple at this point, Apple is worth so much. I mean, don't get me wrong. No corporation should be above the law. Money should not be above the law. But the disruptive nature of, I mean, you know, Every second, okay, you. Apple is the way Apple functions at the top is incredibly intense. People are not sitting around chit chatting in the executive lounge, smoking cigars and drinking cognac, while the minions are out there, you know, doing the work. So the disruptive nature of when you're taking an hour of Johnny Ive's time or an hour of Phil Schiller's time or an hour of Tim Cook's time, etc., you're really talking about it costing the company probably hundreds of thousands, probably millions of dollars an hour.
Yeah, which makes...
Not in salaries, but in effect.
Right. And that puts the $1,100 an hour plus, what is it, another $1,000 an hour for the extra attorney he brought in?
Yeah.
That Bromwich brought in. It kind of puts that in perspective. It's clearly not about the money they're paying him.
Right.
It's about the impact that unnecessary intrusions into the company's
right
activities and top-level executives has.
Now, we should also mention, I know that there were some sites out there that sort of grabbed hold of the fact that Bromwich had to hire an antitrust expert because he doesn't know antitrust law.
But he does know monitoring.
Yeah, that's the thing. Monitors are so rare. He has extensive experience monitoring other companies in past episodes, in past the things,
and he has a very good reputation for it.
Yes, and he prosecuted the Iran-Contra prosecutions. Mm-hmm. Back in the 80s. This guy is the real deal. The fact that he doesn't know antitrust law is not something that's really particularly relevant because he in fact can hire an antitrust regulator. The fact that he knows that he understands monitoring is more important than the fact that he doesn't know antitrust law.
Right, right.
And I feel like it's important to make, because a lot of people were trying to make hay out of that. And I don't think there's any hay to be made.
I agree. That's something that people are latching on to because I think it's because it's an easy topic to wrap your head around.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that people are, you know, evil for doing that. It's not anything. You know, we're here to set it straight.
Right. There are plenty of reasons to be upset about how this is playing out. That is not one of them.
Yeah. And plus his motives, I think, are probably reasonable. I mean, he thinks he's doing what Judge Coat wants him to do, and he may be sure. And he may be doing what Judge Coat wants him to do. I just think they're both wrong.
Yeah, there you go. He is probably doing exactly what Judge Coat is expecting of him. It just so happens to be that's inappropriate. Mm-hmm.
In our opinion.
And that's what really matters.
On this show, that's exactly what matters.
That's right.
Okay, we've already gone long. Shocking.
We're good at that.
Yeah, shocking. So, Junior, what's... Yeah, you. No, the other one. Yeah. Good. Okay, thank you.
Sylvia? No, what's his name?
Silhouette. Sierra.
I've heard it both ways.
No lip from you, sir.
Tell his friend Audrey to knock it off.
Audrey. Now you can't get your own intern's name right?
My intern has a name?
Yes, it's Ainsley with two E's. Somewhere he stuck two E's into, or his parents stuck two E's into the name Ainsley.
This is what's wrong with society today.
Yes, right. That's what's wrong. That's not our treatment of our interns.
I know, and I'm really disappointed because that bottle of podcasting juice that Angus knocked over still hasn't been replaced.
Yeah, we'll have to see about that. All right, so before we run out of rapid fire time, which one do you want to look at first?
Oh, we have so many things we could talk about.
3D patents.
Thank you.
Go.
3D patents. Okay, so Apple has been granted a patent this week for a software-based system that will take two images and put them together into a stereoscopic image, meaning a 2D image that appears three-dimensional.
So it's... Are they choosing from a series of images?
Yes. So
they're choosing from two?
Well, they choose from a series and then pick the best two and put those together to make the stereoscopic image.
Mm.
And that's cool. That's interesting. What's more interesting to me, though, is that Apple applied for a different patent, I believe it was last spring, that describes a system where you can use a single camera to capture photos or videos in 3D.
Mm.
And that's really cool in and of itself, because typically what you need to do is have multiple cameras, or you need to have something that's stationary and you can then properly position a single camera and take multiple shots and put everything together and then create your 3D image. But being able to do it all with a single lens, so you just hold up your camera, your iPhone in this case, take a photograph and it's 3D, or capture video and it's 3D. Excuse me, that's really cool and that's really compelling. So when you put that together with this patent that they were just granted, what I see is a signal from Apple that they're very interested in making good 3D photography and video capture available to the masses.
Well, and they've also patented some 3D technologies on the viewing side.
They have.
There was the I hate to call it a screen, but there was the method of
it was the multiplane screen that created a three-dimensional effect.
Yes, without glasses.
Without glasses, that's right.
Yeah, so we have a series of 3D related patents that Apple has been filing.
Oh, and because it's a hot topic right now, I can tie it into wearable technology for you.
Okay.
The patent that talks about the cameras for 3D capture also has mention of new technology for facial recognition and for recognizing facial gestures.
Hmm.
Which could be used in wearable technology to supplement the user interface. And if you have something that can accurately gauge three dimensions through which would also work for photography, it would probably be a much better system for accurately interpreting facial gestures.
Huh.
And this is all stuff that I just thought of while we started recording.
I like it.
Yeah, so there you go. That's kind of an interesting avenue this
will
take.
To me, this is yet more proof that Apple can't innovate. Right?
That's right. The world's been three-dimensional for as long as we can remember. What's Apple bringing to that?
what's Apple bringing to the table? Well played, sir. I like that.
Yeah, thanks.
I like that. All right. Yeah, thanks for the bell. Let's see. How about one of my passions? Two of my passions. Let's do two of my passions.
Let me guess. If I were a betting man and I had digital money to spend, I would bet that you want to talk about online gaming and Bitcoin.
I do. In fact, I want to talk about seals with clubs.
I just love that name.
Seals with clubs. It's sealswithclubs.com. It's a poker site that... Oh, I'm sorry. sealswithclubs.eu. We have a link in the show notes. In fact, there's a link in the show notes with an affiliate link. So, like, absolutely and positively, if you're going to check them out, please do so through our affiliate link. Anyway, long story short, is they're a poker site, but they all currency is Bitcoin. So, and they allow U.S. players. Now, I'm going to say right up front, whether or not that makes it legal to play poker at Seals with Clubs is another issue, and I don't know the answer. I frankly don't care personally, because I don't think that there's no recourse. Bitcoin is so new that there's a lot of things that aren't decided.
It's its own digital frontier right now.
It is. As a matter of fact, Seals with Clubs makes it very clear that they're the Wild West of poker. Chat may not all be in English, and that's not against the rules. Which means that, you know, if you got two people going back at each other in a language that you don't know, they could be colluding. You just don't, you don't know.
You wouldn't know.
Et cetera. So, you know, it's definitely for people who don't mind a little gamble, but if you have Bitcoins, you can move some Bitcoins into Seals with Clubs and play poker, and they won't block you out for being in the U.S.
And
they have a Mac client.
And it's a Bitcoin-based thing.
Yeah, it's Bitcoin-based. And your money stays in Bitcoins, by the way. So you're playing, the way it works is they play in denominations of chips. So one chip is what they're calling it. One chip is a thousandth of a Bitcoin, which right now basically is about $1.11. And there are a few sub-chip games. So there's a 0.05, 0.01 chip game, which is, like as of this particular moment, is roughly a 6-cent, 12-cent game. So they do have some low-stakes games on there, but all the currency stays in Bitcoin. So you move Bitcoin in and you move Bitcoin out, it never becomes dollars, it never becomes euros, never becomes yuan, which means that you're protected from the incredible price fluctuations that Bitcoin has been undergoing for the last month.
Okay, here's what I find really interesting about this. Mm-hmm. There's a couple places you can look to see what technologies are likely to become mainstream, mm-hmm. and that's porn and gambling.
Yep.
And to see a place like Seals with Clubs saying, yep, we're going to allow our online gaming system to work with Bitcoin, that tells me that Bitcoin is getting the beginnings of its mainstream foothold.
Yeah, that's probably true. There's actually a couple of there's several gambling sites out there that do deal in Bitcoin, but most of them are casino style, like dice and high-lo and all kinds of things where you're playing against the house and you're always going to lose. There's also a couple of poker sites that deal in Bitcoin. Seals with Clubs is actually 2 years old now, and they the only currency they do is Bitcoin. They do not deal in any kind of the fiat currencies. Like I said, the euro, the dollar, et cetera, the pound. They don't have anything to do with those whatsoever. So, like I said, it's quasi-legal to do it here in the States, or maybe quasi-illegal, or maybe just flat illegal. You have to investigate that yourself. But it's interesting to me. Super interesting.
Yeah. And like I said, I think that this, along with the other gaming and gambling sites that are now accepting Bitcoin, shows that we're hitting a point where Bitcoin has the ability to move beyond just a digital currency for the tech savvy.
Yep.
And has the potential to become a currency for the mainstream.
Yeah, I don't know.
Not overnight.
Widely used, yes. I don't know about mainstream, but widely used, yes.
All right, I will grant you that. I will accept widely used instead of mainstream.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to be doing a written review of this because, you know, they do have a Mac client, and I am interested in both poker and Bitcoin, so that'll be going up probably in the next day or two. Cool. And meanwhile, check it out. If you are risk averse, don't check it out.
That's fair enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want anyone messing with this on my word if they're not willing to undergo a little risk.
Except for Savannah. We expect that of him.
Sierra.
Him too. Yeah.
Well, he's the one that actually had play.
Yeah, see, this is really smart. This is why we have interns.
Exactly. Can you imagine actually trusting that guy to play poker? Good Lord, that's with my money? No way. It's crazy. Anyway.
It's pretend money.
As the bell notes. What do we have? We have Black Friday?
We have Black Friday. And what we have for Black Friday is that it was an iPad kind of holiday.
It was an iPad kind of holiday. The iPad definitely was the loss leader of choice for all the big names.
Okay, so the iPad Mini was the number one seller at Walmart on Thanksgiving and on Black Friday. Mm-hmm. It's just so weird to say on Thanksgiving.
Yeah. That's probably a topic for another show.
Yeah. And the iPad Air was the top seller at Target, followed by the iPad Mini. At Best Buy, the iPad 2 was the number two bestseller. And the number one bestseller? I'm serious, people. The Microsoft Surface.
Huh.
Yeah. And we don't have any other information to go along with that, but I do find it really interesting. I think there what's more likely, because, okay, so here's the top three at Best Buy. The 32 gig Surface, and then the 16 gig iPad 2, and then the Kindle Fire HD, I believe. Mm-hmm. So a product that was $199, followed by a product that's $299, followed by a product that's $99. So the $99 Kindle Fire could not sell better than a three-year-old Apple tablet priced at $300.
That's not too surprising. Yeah, the iPad 2 compared to the Kindle Fire HD is hands down the winner.
I agree. But we're talking about $100, and for some people, that $100 is all that they will see.
Yeah, absolutely.
So my guess, though, for the Surface outselling at Best Buy is that Best Buy, for whatever reason, simply didn't have enough inventory of iPad Airs and iPad Minis to outsell.
Well, you know what I think it was? Like, there's just no way. There's just no way that the Surface would outsell the iPad if the iPad Air was there, because the iPad Air is so much better. So I think that it's probable, you know, it's what I heard was that, like, Microsoft paid Best Buy not to offer the iPad Air and not to have any inventory on hand so that they could sell more Surfaces. That's totally what happened.
I want to know who gave Sierra a microphone. Put it down. We need to have a talk with these interns.
Yeah, we do. Now, I don't. Such a ridiculous hypothetical is certainly within Microsoft's playbook, but they'd have to pay. I don't think that happened.
I don't think that happened.
I don't actually think it happened. I cannot understand how the Surface outsold the Air if Airs were there.
Right. And of course, it took an intern to come up with that whole scheme.
Yes. Certainly not my fault.
Oh, absolutely not.
No. And the other thing on Black Friday with the iPads is that once again, iPad and iOS and iPhone crushed Android on shopping, total traffic, and then total sales. Online sales. So, in other words, purchases made from iPhones and iPads dwarfed the purchases made from Android devices, like, I mean, by a factor of, I don't know, 4 or 5 to 1. And then wasn't the, didn't we do a story? Who did the story? Did you write the story on?
I wrote the story, the salt in the wound story.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it was over 60% of the iPad purchases that were made online over the Thanksgiving holiday. So that would have been on Thursday and Friday. Mm-hmm. Were made from Android smartphones.
That's pretty funny.
It is, but I think we finally found the answer to your question, Brian, which is, what are people doing with their Android devices?
They're ordering iPads.
They're buying iPads.
Well, but what, it's just, well, again, the answer is increasingly clear. Android tablets don't use for much of anything, period, and Android phones get used as fancy feature phones, except at the high end. At the high end, they're used as smartphones the same as people are using iPhones, but at the low end, they're just fancy feature phones. People text with them, maybe take a photograph or two, and then make phone calls, and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And buy iPads.
And buy iPads, apparently. Apparently. Yeah. All right.
So Android can out... I heard the bell. Knock it off. So Android can outsell iOS, but iOS is still the dominant operating system.
It's dominant in terms of usage, and it's telling in terms of usage. But there you have it. All right, we're gonna run out of time, so let's actually move on to what is supposed to be our final main topic.
I don't even remember now.
Samsung and Apple, and the case of the mysterious transfer of information.
Yeah, that's right. See, we've talked about so much court stuff today, I completely forgot about that. So the deal is that Apple and Nokia both filed papers with the court that are asking for quite a few sanctions against Samsung and Samsung executives. And one of those sanctions includes...
Tell them why. What those...
Oh, that's right. Because not everyone knows. Okay, so Quinn Emanuel is the law firm that's been representing Samsung in their patent infringement fights against Apple in the United States. They had access to confidential documents related to the licensing negotiations that Apple and Samsung had conducted with each other.
Licensing, the actual licensing terms that were reached. And the reason why they needed that information was so as they were making the case for what Apple should have to pay Samsung for licensing its patents.
Right. So that information was supposed to go only to special witnesses. And what Quinn Emanuel did was shot them all over to Samsung servers. Unedited.
Yeah.
And unredacted.
Unredacted. So, yeah, put them up on an internal Samsung server where they were. It was then shared with many top Samsung executives so that they all had these secret, confidential business terms, which gives them an incredible leg up when they're doing their own negotiations, not only with Apple and Nokia, but with anyone else, too.
Right. And Samsung had the audacity to say during their negotiations with Nokia that they had access to these documents.
Yeah, we already know those terms. So, you know, pay up this or that amount, or we'll pay this or that amount, or whatever it was.
Right. So Samsung says, stuff happens, and it was an accident.
All information leaks.
And Quinn Emanuel is saying, yeah, that was an accident. It wasn't supposed to go there. But hey, you know, at least no harm came out of it. And Apple and Nokia are going, whoa, back up the Wayback Machine, people, because there is a problem here. So part of the sanctions that Apple and Nokia are asking the court to impose include blocking Samsung executives from being able to participate in licensing negotiations for a set amount of time.
Right. And they also want for Samsung and Quinn Emanuel to have to disclose, like a little public shaming, to disclose to anyone else that they are dealing with that this happened. In other words, they, you know, it's like I said, it's a little public shaming, and they also want those executives who were involved, including Dr. An, to be precluded from mobile licensing related deals negotiations for a period of 2 years.
And Nokia had their own added piece that they're hoping for that I just completely forgot about.
What Nokia wanted was for Quinn Emanuel not to be allowed to represent Samsung in any action on the other side of the table from Nokia.
That's right. Thank you.
Because they've lost faith in Quinn Emanuel's ability to properly handle confidential information.
My guess is that part won't fly.
Oh, probably not.
But the other parts at least, the public shaming may not fly, but blocking executives from certain types of negotiations, I could see that happening.
Yeah, it seems like that could possibly happen. Although, here's the deal with that: the chances of these executives not further sharing the information that they have, to me, is slim to none.
Oh, I agree completely. This is a symbolic gesture.
It is a symbolic, it's a symbolic slap on the wrist. It's really what it is. I mean, this is the thing that kept sort of resonating in my head. Apple and Nokia both, but let's focus on Apple because that's what we do. Apple wants Samsung to have consequences for its actions. They mishandled confidential information. It was wrong. Everyone knows it's wrong. This is not how that particular game is played. Everyone knew that they were breaking the rules. They did it anyway. They don't care. They have this massive track record of cheating all the time. They cheat on their benchmarks. They copy patents because they want to. They have no shame about any of this stuff. And Apple seems to be pretty intent on there being some consequences for these particular sets of actions that were well outside the appropriate codes of conduct that govern these sorts of things. And it seems like the judge is at least entertaining the idea of making that happen, making there be consequences.
Yes, that it looks that way right now. So we'll see what happens. But the fact that the court is entertaining the sanctions as opposed to just flat out saying no, that tells me that the court is at least inclined to agree that something needs to be done and there needs to be some sort of consequence.
Yeah. Yes.
That was, while not a rapid fire, that was, I think, the most efficient rapid fire we've actually done.
No, that was still a good 7 minutes. Heading towards 8, even as I speak.
Yeah, that's true. Nonetheless, for us, that still qualifies as pretty good for rapid fire enough. Time. Yeah,
fair enough. All right. Well, I think that we've done. I think we've sort of chewed these, gnawed these stories to the bone.
I think so. And they were yummy.
Mm-hmm. I should take us out.
Okie doke. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening. Feel free to follow me on Twitter and app.net. I'm Jay Gamut both places. And head on over to the iTunes store and rate our show for us because we love it when you do that.
Indeed. And you can follow me on Twitter at TMOBrian. That's Brian with a Y. Our content is written by the good people at The Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by The Cashfly. The bass is by The Boom, recorded just for the TMO. And that's all for this week.
And stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at The Mac Observer.